forth. From the beginning of their existence, the striving to pay as quickly as possible for one's arising and individuality, in order afterward to be free to lighten the vibrational density of our collective zero-point field. Somehow it doesn't, that doesn't cut it, does it? Thank you.
Is that a new interpretation? Is that a translation? What was that?
That's Gurdjieff for secular humanists.
Thank you for making it clear. I am insisting.
If you prefer the NSRV version, we're selling them. But you get the difference. Somehow translating it into the language of the great, what is sorrow but the vibrational density? And our common father, according to modern astrophysical calculations, stripped of the gender language which insults the human planet anyway, could be more beautifully conceived of as a zero-point field. So our duty then is to pay as quickly as possible for one's arising in individuality in order afterward to be free to lighten as much as possible the vibrational density of our common collective zero-point field. Done! Okay, you make my point. I hope you make my point by laughing. That it is in the language of the personal that this fourth striving reaches us and sears our heart. It's in the shocking image of our common father, blatantly relational language, and the sorrow. It's in that that something startles awake and the seeds of remorse of conscience are awakened in us in these strivings, if they're to be awakened at all. Up to that point, as we looked at yesterday, it's an easy ride, you know. Not that the strivings are easy to do, but they don't in any sense conflict with enlightened self-interest. You know, it's a perfectly good and wonderful and much appreciated thing in a world where spiritual progress was often equated with raw penance, to be told that the first striving is to acquire for yourself everything truly necessary for the satisfaction of the planetary animal, you know, to keep it in good working order. Whew. And then when you get told that the next striving is to strive with real intensity for your perfection of being, oh, bring it on, I'm almost perfect anyway, a little bit more. And then the third, Enneagram 5 paradise. Come on, let's learn more and more about these laws. So far so good, but then bang! Out of the text, suddenly from nowhere, a whole different language of grief and relationality, and with the attempt that it's going to stir you in a way that that self-interest can never stir a person. Stir those deep wellsprings of self-giving and goodness that really are at the heart of the human soul. So that was just a sort of example of the personal at work. And I believe that it's at the personal that Gurdjieff and Teilhard actually both most subtly and deeply meet. That it's in this kind of scratchy, uncomfortably tender and intimate bandwidth of relationality and love, often expressing itself in perfectly comfortably in the outer vestments of the old religious language and tradition and music. It's in this that something of the heart of both of their teachings is touched. But it's very, very hard sell nowadays to even raise the possibility that Gurdjieff's heart and roots and real kind of center of gravity is in the personal. Because I think almost from the beginning in this teaching and coming on into this day, there has been an attempt, sincere but intentional, to transpersonalize or depersonalize his work. Translating it into an interesting system of ideas, an intricate Rubik's Cube of transformation, and most likely, and most recently, a plunge into the great impersonal face of the higher subtle energies. And I've come to believe that this is a misinterpretation, a skewing of the heart of what's in the teaching, and that to return to the heart of Gurdjieff and to unlock his teaching and to harmonize it with the real places where he's making contact with the other great transformational streams is really to wade into this ground of the personal and see how he stands there. So that's what I want to do, and some of this is sheer opinion, and you'll probably know that anyway, but I'll try and be clear about that. To begin with, just to set the context, Gurdjieff came into his responsible age, as he would call it, just at kind of one of those peaks in the rational thought structure, again using Gebser's really helpful categories. And in late 19th century, early 20th century, where the whole rational mode of discourse and the mental egoic generation of itself was at that point where it had reached its sort of the end point of its creativity and was already beginning to turn into what Gebser calls the deficient mental structures. You know, we're coming down from the top of the arc to the bottom. So it's a culture of that in the middle rational structure, what's at the height of it is a sense of ratio. It's abstractionist. It's self-removed. It's the height of the non-participative consciousness. It's the height of where we stand outside and observe and know from the outside looking in. It's the height of linearity, the dominion of the mental center. So this is the culture he came into. And to make matters worse, or more challenging, we shall say, his mission then sent him in successive swaths west. He arrived in Russia just as all hell was about to break loose. On the eve of the outbreak of the First World War, as with the rest of Europe, but with a communist revolution waiting in the wings. So by the time that he was fleeing from his life and his first attempts at establishing orderly groups had just ended in chaos in that society, there were not only allies and axes and, you know, hostile armies in the whole of Europe, but you never know in Russia what kind of an army you were going to be shot at. The Reds, the Whites, but you knew the chances of dying were pretty great. And so under those conditions, Gurdjieff first launched his teaching, and then moved it in a jumble, hopping from exile to exile, steadily west, through the Ukraine, through Tbilisi, Essentuki, briefly into Constantinople, and now what? Somewhere in Europe. And it was almost like playing with a dartboard, you know, where's the dart going to stick? And it wound up sticking in France after some bids, you know, and a lot of pressure to locate in either Germany, thank God he didn't do that, or England. And somehow England never quite worked out. In one of these great ironies, Ouspensky got England and Gurdjieff got France, and probably temperamentally it would have worked out a lot better if they'd switched. But be it as it is. So Gurdjieff not only has to communicate a system into language, but he has to communicate it into language and a whole sort of way of speaking and understanding that had reached almost its Baroque input in pre-World War I Europe. So the first run-up on presenting the work found him laying out a very tidy and orderly system of ideas. And in this work, he recruited Ouspensky. And Ouspensky was essential to the formulation and early dissemination of the work. It wouldn't have happened without him. Ouspensky was already a well-established philosopher with a good reputation, a wonderful intellectual mind, and a demonstrated penchant for the search and a sense of the search back in origin. So he was a perfect foil to Gurdjieff to take these ideas, package them in a way that was a tidy system of ideas. And it tends to be characteristic of almost any teaching at its young phase that it's the most ornate and most cerebral. And a typical teacher will tend to be fancier at the beginning and then simplify as life goes on. And that same pattern is true in spades in Gurdjieff. But essentially, the early iteration of the teaching was very, very cerebral indeed. And it's that teaching that Ouspensky took on and really planted as the system in the groups he worked with. Gurdjieff worked with it really, really hard for a while, and then by the mid-20s in France, he realized that something just wasn't working. And in kind of cumulative strippings over the next two decades, the teaching became more experimental, more experiential, very much more simple, less elaborate as a system, until by the end of his life it had simplified down to almost simply the sheer gesture of feeding and nurturing and correcting excessive lies. But bottom line is that people still routinely enter the gate of the work through Ouspensky, through reading In Search of the Miraculous, and the standard protocol in which the teaching is delivered is sequential, starting with the head. So if you actually embrace the work, particularly in a foundation group as I did, you begin with a couple of years at a reading group where the idea is that you master the basic concepts of this. And then if you're still hanging out and you've also mastered the protocol of not screaming in frustration, but you may be invited to practical work. and then invited to movements. And from this kind of a formation, it's very, very easy to get the idea that the work is cerebral. And if you read any kind of chatter on the web about it, many people will say this. You know, they'll take one look at the chemical factories and things like this and say, God, this is just for nerds. So there is, you know, this, that one first screen that emanates in the early iteration of the teaching in Gurdjieff himself, which tends to feature the abstract, the conceptual, the systematic. As we all know in this room, you cut right through that the moment you get out on the movements floor. But if people don't get to get out on the movements floor, you know, it may take a long, long time before they even begin to suspect that the work has a heart and an actual pathway of inner transformation, which is far more tender than what presents at first glance. So that's some of the reason that we get the idea that we're dealing with a mental teaching. It's based in its history of transmission. And I would say that second within this, you know, we can't just say, it would be completely inaccurate to say that his students misunderstood him. That Gurdjieff himself was appropriately gun-shy about, you know, pulling out the stops on the personal and on the devotional, because of his fear that it would jerk people right back into their Pavlovian religious responses, which it would have. Remember the early formulations of man number 1, 2, and 3, and man number 2, the monk, who wants to get there by feeling alone, feeling at that point indistinguishable from emotion. And so you wump up the fires of devotion, it's basically an addictive path to keep the feelings totally on high all the time. And in that kind of path, manipulation and delusion run rampant, as any good parish priest knows. You know, it's just, and you get caught in your own rhetorical loops. I remember one of the most shocking displays I've ever seen of just this sort of fatal blindsidedness when you get into this kind of a loop. We were at the University of British Columbia, and the University of, and there's a little seminary, Vancouver School of Theology, which was a very, very fine Anglican seminary. But like all the seminaries, was beginning to find itself in financial difficulty in a failing church. So they did the usual thing, and they merged with the UCC seminary, and they merged, and they eventually got a whole bunch of Christian denominations together that just detested each other. But they detested going under individually more than they detested each other. So there they were. And they're still saying, well, we are faithful, we are true, we are bearing Christ, and we are keeping witness in distant times. On went the rhetoric. Somebody came up with a bright idea. We sit on university lands which have been deeded to us, that have been deeded to the seminary. We could sell them, put up high-rise buildings, make money from the rent, you know, or lease them, and use this to run our deficit. So off they went, building these god-awful apartments, and somebody said, well, you know, you can make more money if you want to do it by making them a little taller. So they built this whole complex of buildings that very quickly engulfed the chapel, the great seminary hall, and then they became a brunt of a rebellion of people who pointed out that the land that they'd sold for high rise was Aboriginal grounds.
Oh my gosh.
And so they were now tarred with the brush of political incorrectness. And then when they finally got these damned high-rises built and with all the construction and delay, they went three times over budget. And so rather than having a new endowment, they drained the remains of it. And then the new tenants looked and said, what is this building here sitting in the middle of our, this could be a parking lot. And so the Citizens Union pressured them to deconstruct the chapel so they would have room for it. It was like, and all the time, we are being faithful, and now we are being hounded, but oh, we are devoted, you know. It's just like, hello, you know, caught in your Fruit Loop. You know? And you know, you would think that any intelligent person would sit down and say, well, we have a product that isn't selling, so what's wrong? But because the man number two, that whole path is so infected with self-delusion and rhetorical manipulation, passing for faith, that it tends to create just kind of blindness. And hysteria, and of course we don't need to rehearse the complicit and disgraceful role of religion in the fueling of all wars and misbehavior. So Gurdjieff, for proper reasons, was very, very leery of turning people loose on the hallucinogens of devotion, adoration, until they could establish a ground in which they could stand in themselves. So that was, I think that was the true source of the reticence and the tendency in his teaching to backpedal heavily on what I think in the long run turns out to be its big gap. You know, it's big missing link, it's failure to affirm emphatically enough that we receive help at all stages of the journey. And that that the path of sincere striving does not lead you to hopelessness. That the effort counts and is met. I think that's a missing piece, and when we look at how Gurdjieff and Teilhard help each other, I think it's in that area that Teilhard has some help to offer. People give up, it feels too hopeless, particularly when you have interpretations of things such as was current in our group, that first conscious shock was about awakening, you know, and this was the work of self-remembering, and since we couldn't do it anyway, that it was going to consume the rest of your life. And then second, conscious shock was so high and would never come anyway that people gave up. And they suffered, they settled for what my dear teacher, Bruno Barnhart, the Canalese monk, he says, they settled for a manageable complexity rather than an unmanageable simplicity. So, but the final level occurred in a transmutation that happened in the work, at least in the major line of it, in the foundation line of the work, after Gurdjieff's death, and a while into the tenure of Madame de Saltzman, who was his heir apparent, and who was carefully prepared to carry on the work after his death, and did for many, many, many years. She died in 1990 at the age of 101 on Ascension Day, as I recall, and really held the thing together and shaped the work as it flowed out into the 20th and now 21st century, at least in its most officially designated line. But around, oh, maybe 15 years ago, mumblings and grumblings began in the tent that in the process that something new was emerging, that Madame de Saltzman had launched what began to be called the New Work. And James Moore was the first one to get onto this, sort of insinuating that she had modified some very basic and fundamental pillars of the work in favor of sort of spiritual imports that did not generically belong to the picture, and that some of these were in the area of aim and struggle. So James Moore was the first person to sort of raise this heresy, and he did not have his head removed directly because he had a little bit of status in the work in England. He was one of the leaders of some branch of the British groups. But Joseph Aziz came back to that with what you might call a vengeance. If you've been reading his Gurdjieff practices, you'll find that he really tackles that right on. That successively she introduces an increasingly what you might call Asian and passive emphasis to the work, which grows up at a slight shift of emphasis in the direction of the sittings, in her reliance more and more for the sources you complement and supplement Gurdjieff with, Krishnamurti, Karl Graf von Durkheim, whom she worked with quite a bit in the years after Gurdjieff's death, looking again for a kind of new spiritual presence, and her increasingly close friendship with one of the first generation students, William Siegel, who we all know and love well in our particular branch of this because he wrote that wonderful book on, the power of attention. But he spent a good deal of his time post Gurdjieff's death. He moved to Japan and worked very, very strongly in the Zen currents there. So a much more Zen, be present, be here, receive the higher energies, flow and downflow, began to get introduced into a teaching where the earlier accents from the days of the priori and other things had to do with aim and struggle. Well, this did not make Aziz popular. The foundation does not take lightly to having its backside exposed. And the veneration of Madame de Saltzman is just. I mean, she did remarkable things and was a presence to contend with. But nonetheless, if you want to have a picture of what happens, the whole picture, so you can see where some of the unemphasized dimensions of the teaching, how it all happened, as the law of seven rolled merrily on, these are really important. That was the group I met when I first entered formation in the work. I worked in a branch of the New York Foundation Group in Halifax, carefully under the wing of Madame de Saltzman through one of her primary protégés, Ravi Ravindra, who's still around and was my first teacher in the work, a scholar of Krishnamurti, and Indian by birth. And they held that group. But I became aware in the sittings that it seemed like it was more and more a search for a certain vibration of subtle energy. And that there was, I was hearing a different accent from what I heard when I read Beelzebub, certainly when I read it out loud. And that what was beginning to go on was a certain transpersonalization of the work. So that our common father language and the Lord have mercy language and the prayer language began to disappear even more decisively from the ambience of the work. But listen to these things and see what you can pick up as the as a really subtle current here, but if your eyes are sharp, you'll hear something has shifted subtly. These are a couple of passages from Madame de Saltzman's take on the Lord have mercy exercise, her instruction, you know, there are various iterations of Gospodi pomilu, Lord have mercy. And she's commenting about this, that I have access to myself. She started to talk out, we start out with the God language, but listen to where it goes. In man, it is the mind that is opposed to the body. The neutralizing force is the wish that unites them, connects them. Everything comes from the wish, the will. To represent God, it is necessary to represent these three forces. Where the three forces are reunited, God is. Where our attention is, God is. When two forces are opposed and a third unites them, God is here. We can say, Lord, have mercy on me. We can ask for help to come to this in ourselves. The only help is this. Our aim is this, to contain, to unite these three forces in us, to be. Hear how it's slowly, now listen. I have access to myself only through sensation, but there are different kinds of sensation. I need to open and receive the impression of a finer vibration. For this, a new feeling needs to appear that allows the vibration to spread. This is why Gurdjieff had us say, Lord, have mercy, which opens us to a feeling of our nothingness and awakens a deeper energy. So the purpose of Lord, have mercy, then, it's a teaching tool to awaken us, to open us to a feeling of our nothingness and awaken a deeper energy. That's the purpose of it. And continuing, my deep wish is to submit entirely to an inner voice, the feeling of the divine, of the sacred in me. I know that a higher energy, what religions call God or Lord, is within me. It will appear if the mind and the body are truly related. God is here when two forces are opposed and a third unites them. We can ask for help in order to unite these forces in us. We can say, Lord, have mercy, in order to be. Have you seen that we're no longer quite talking here about lightening the sorrow of our common father? We're talking about saying that behind these venerable words, which in old times were called prayers, lie the lines of convergence of three forces. And when we master them sufficiently, they will appear, and then we will begin to be. See how the arc has bent back subtly, so that instead of instead of preparing our being so that it can become a place where we can worthily serve our common father. Our common father becomes a reservoir that we can dip into to serve our being emergence. And you notice that in place of this language that is personalized and evocative, we have, it is the higher energy. It is the higher energy. It is the higher energy. We've shifted back into what Ken Wilber calls spirit in third person. Abstracted, removed, totally contained within the mental thought form. Does that make sense at all? It's very, very subtle. But it's a sharply different accent.
Is that from reality of being?
That's from reality of being. And you just...
What page is that?
Well,
in his book?
It's in 241 to 43.
Okay.
It's so very, very subtle how the emphases shift. We start talking about God, and it's just fine. We talk about the Holy Spirit and the three forces, but all of a sudden, we're talking about the three lines of forces, and we're no longer... We've got mental forces. We've got a mechanistic universe again. And we've got a passive universe that if we do this right, the forces emerge. Not an awful lot of sense that these forces, being from a higher order, might have intelligence, will, and compassion on their own. You know, not an awful lot of acknowledge of that, at least not in the formation. So in that way, the thing subtly bends back to become a self-perfecting, you know, with being still held in, I would maintain, in my usual sense of self, enhanced by an increasing subtleization that allows you to catch long vibrations of this more subtle behind. But without then any connection either to the going forth into the world, to either the sorrow of our common father or the mission of the holy individuals. You know, the Ashiyat Shemashas and others that are sent forth to try and do their bit for these wretched human beings. The dimension of the collective, the dimension of the accountability, tend to get soft play. So that was what I was exposed to, and it wasn't until I met Ray Fountain-Snowbass, who had been studying the work in the Bennett line through the books, and was able to capture something else, who showed me how to reunite it with Christian mysticism in a way that kind of got that heart back in it. So Aziz named that as a subtle distortion, said that Gurdjieff was, in a sense, struggling with it in the last, you know, decades of his life, as his own life became overtly more religious and his teaching. I don't know, you know, that's one of Aziz's contentions, but at least he's got the thing out on the table now for people to consider. Somebody say
something. I just wanted to comment, when I read that section, I immediately had the image of Jesus giving the kingdom, the keys to the kingdom, to Peter, who had betrayed him. I'm not saying Madden Saltzman betrayed him. But I wondered if that was intentional, if he knew that she may take it in that direction, and that it would take another generation, the grandson generation, Bennett, to bring it back to the heart where Brigitte felt it was the one who he was.
That's a really interesting thing to watch, you know, that I think that what we can say without without much hesitation is that there does seem to be a movement in the sections of the work that are staying alive to reach more deeply into the heart, more deeply into innovation, in innovation in terms of receptivity to other streams of life, to hospitality and more open, creating more open systems. These things all seem to be happening, and as they happen, there tends to be an infusion of a more, you know, of a balance that seems more consistent with the person of Gurdjieff that emanates from the pages of Beelzebub. That this, you know, Gurdjieff certainly had, you know, the systems are important and can't be disregarded because they're the part of seeing where it is that we get pinned. But over and over, as you just read the spirit of this wonderful tale that really was his magnum opus, and in key places it disagrees quite firmly, not only with the gestalt of the more cerebral line of the work, but with some of the teaching, actually. There's some sense that there's some things that Ospinsky passed on in his edition that Gurdjieff had refined by the time he'd come to the end of his life. Anyway, living tension. I don't want to dwell there, and I'm not going to speak intensely myself about how the Bennett line fits in all this, partly because it wouldn't be appropriate to do so, because I have people, there are people here who have been faithful stewards of that line. I know, as I was alluding to yesterday, that J.G. Bennett, who had this sort of large, expansive, roving kind of magpie soul anyway, you know, caught Gurdjieff right at the end and was a student at those tables and caught a direct heart dose of the maturing of love in this person, which he preserved faithfully, I think, as this core component of it, creating a very, very different center of gravity between this line of the work. There's, of course, more emphasis in the Bennett branch of the work on those on struggle, on aim, on work, on effort. Some of the classic teachings did not get softened in the new work. The exercises were in much more prominence. If there's, you know, from my own position, if there's a weak link to the Bennett side, it's with his incredibly synthetic line where he winds up innovating and making things over intricate and over conceptual and pulling in this and that. But the heart is there, and you can see it. It's one reason why we're sitting in this room now, and not in a studio in New York at a foundation meeting where this would not be on. So, not to get caught too far in the digression, but I believe that the reading and the reconnection with Gurdjieff, particularly through the movements, through the music, and through this magnificent tale of a tale of Beelzebub, gives you the sense that he's for real when he talks about in the fourth striving that we, you know, that this is not done to perfect our being. This is done to improve our being to the degree that we can give assistance, you know, and to make us, in some sense, worthy, to do what we're called to do in the human collective, ready or not. And when you lose that collective, outgoing, nurturing flavor of the work, when it just disappears into subtle intricacy inward, you've lost the real flavor, and you've also lost its astonishing relevance to where we stand right now. That one of the things that has hung me in over the years and that I wrote Eye of the Heart about is because buried in Gurdjieff's teaching is this incredible vision of the megalocosmos, not only our planet, but worlds within worlds, worlds extended in space, the whole solar system, worlds extended in density, the realms, the worlds, the imaginal, the Christic, the all mutually interdependent. And the folk tale he tells, the sort of yarn that gets the whole thing started, you know, is that, and you can only do it in the language of folk tale and myth, that once upon a time, our unicosmic, all-father splendiferous dwelt on his planet, the Holy Sun Absolute, in splendor with his cherubs and archangels. And then he began to notice that it was like living on Sanibel Island in Florida. Each year erosion was claiming a little bit more of his planet, that the thing was getting nibbled away. And he says, horrors, what could cause this calamity, which we know where that's going to end. And he discovered time, the merciless Heropas, was nibbling away at the shores of the holy planet Absolute, and that by this process of entropy, that the whole thing would eventually dissolve. And there he would be, a wonderful, preposterous beginning, but you get it. So he says, we've got to generate some sort of principle that counteracts the force of entropy in the planet so I can save my home. And what could this be? And so the counter-entropic force is created by establishing through the system of planets and worlds this great kind of system of reciprocal feeding, where every corner, every niche, every planet, every realm produces a certain kind of energy, which is food for contiguous realms. It eats and is eaten. But in the process, particularly in some processes that I'm not going to elaborate too much here, but that have a lot to do with our human placement in the order of realms, right on either side of the first conscious shock, we have an opportunity in a particular way to participate in the turn that begins to generate out of what Teilhard would call tangential energy, just pure old mechanical force, radial energy, which is counter-entropic, which is offered back, which generates energy and saves energy in the system. It's a tremendous opportunity, and it's the high side of the maddening consciousness we otherwise have. So we have an opportunity in and through all this difficulty to help in a profound way to stabilize the dynamic and equilibrium of the whole megalocosmos, to pay back, to aid in the nurturance of the world. And at the point that we move into claiming our rightful place as conscious human beings, we begin to do this work. And to the extent we stay here loafing and floating downstream on pain and pleasure, perfecting our isolation, triumphing in our power, you know, we add to the entropy, you know. or we contribute less profoundly to this real opportunity to turn, to give something back. So it's the collective, profoundly, cosmically collective breadth of his vision of everything connected. And then at some point you fall through the parable of our poor common father sitting on his diminishing piece of real estate, and fall through that, through the heart, into the cost of there being anything at all, and how all finite beings share in assuming that cost. And we either do it willingly or unwillingly. But to willingly step up to the plate and assume our share in it creates a whole different radiance in the world and creates a whole different outcome. And my take is that human beings have forgotten this. It certainly is not talked about in the churches, in the intellectual establishments where it's laughed right out of the picture still. And we're left with what we're left with today, the political society, a passionately crazy right and an impotent left. Where is the remembrance of what it is that we were called and invested with the capacity to be and to do and to give on behalf of the all, which is the only place where we will ever find either meaning or happiness? So he names it, and he has a very, very good map. If you cut through the embroidery that scares people at the start, you know, the intricate diagrams, I'm trying to say, well, what's the point of this? Why should I learn this? Where is it going? What is it calling forth in me? And that's what we've been trying to sit with. But to trust this person and to see his heart and to see this is not a heart who's trying to dissect the three forces of God so he could get a little bit of each one of them to increase his being. It isn't that. It's how can I put myself together enough that I can be barely worthy to do what a human being has to do. And what the work is really intended to do, I think, is to expose the ways in which we lie and deceive ourselves and delude ourselves and never even get the bulk part, and then begin to give us some access to the practices, the awarenesses, the collectively generated or received energies that allow some of this other to begin to emerge. So, what can Teilhard learn from Gurdjieff? Coming back to the questions with which this began, what is there in the Gurdjieff work that might specifically address some of the shortcomings and blind spots and stuck points in the Teilhardian teaching? And I would say that first and foremost among them is the whole idea of levels of consciousness, and the strong affirmation that being and knowledge are different critters, and that the term noetic covers a wide variety of sins, but intellectual curiosity. Gurdjieff had all these wonderful phrases like wiseacring and the bon ton literary language to convince, you know, to sort of tease us that so much of we think that we're doing with our great brain, you know, is simply kind of, you know, enlightened masturbation, frankly. And to invite us to realize that meaning, coherence, and agency are not functions of greater knowledge, but but functions of greater being. And I think Teilhard, had he had the language given to him, would have recognized it instantly. But it's the place where students of his work still get stuck, because it's still being approached academically, rationally. You know, we don't have the whole map of the structures of consciousness he was working in. So Gurdjieff could help him, and it could help scholarship to place him and assess him more accurately and certainly more fruitfully. So what can Gurdjieff learn from Teilhard? For me, I think that it would hover around the question once again of the importance of devotion in the mix, and the importance of hope, or as the Christian people would want to say, the reality of grace. And these are, of course, things that Gurdjieff himself knew perfectly well. But in the teaching, these were backpedaled. And in some places where they didn't have an active component of movements and music, they disappeared essentially off the radar screen. We were having a conversation at one of the lunches where someone was saying there's a lot of people in the work that consider themselves atheists. I would say that's impossible. You know, when you really understand the heart of Gurdjieff, it's based on a profound and deep, and I think ultimately theistic faith. But to the extent that that was backpedaled and disguised, to the extent of his lack of trust, in a way, that people could actually, even starting blundering with a little bit of help from this, could move beyond. I think the careful and prudent re-infusion of the deep practices of devotion that actually fed Gurdjieff. The Lord have mercy, we need to dig into this much more deeply, because it does create it's a nexus in which the orthodoxy of the Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox devotions of his childhood, the deep practices of self-inquiry, and his beautiful sense of I am, all meet. And as we access that more deeply, which we hopefully will do if we continue this dialogue, we'll see it. To find an authentic and quiet complement of devotion in the work that people aren't afraid of, that helps to keep the fire of transformation up just enough so that something actually happens, and much quicker too. And the holding out and the reaffirmation again and again that these higher forces, if we have to talk about them as forces to keep people from getting trapped in their 6-year-old, you know, wars with God language, so be it. But the big problem about talking about the more subtle things as energies, as forces, is that we catch the mechanical message from our Newtonian upbringing that this means they're mechanical and passive, and that we learn to manipulate them. We can't possibly imagine an energy having intelligence. It goes off the screen of our mind. We can't imagine an energy having compassion. And we can't imagine an energy being able to directly create these things. Teilhard was talking about that. If you read his little riff on faith in the divine milieu, he says that faith can directly impact the world. And, you know, when it hits a situation, when people can bring in a dimension of life, of faith into a situation, everything in the situation becomes more supple, more relational, more coherent. You know, he understood really clearly that these energy streams that flow out of what we might call the fruits of the spirit are themselves intelligent and efficacious and actually produce on a vibrational level the intentions attributed to them. So we get ourselves out of the driver's seat where, well, we have to wield this. We have to get together and pray and generate some love. And, you know, that love can speak itself. And what we really need to learn to do is to get ourselves out of the way. Again, where the Gurdjieff work can help, because it teaches us that rather than leaning into things when ecstasy starts to take over, that you stand more firmly in your own ground and let it take over. That sets it free to be its own soaring intelligence with the tether in your being, not the flapping wings. So there's a whole wonderful dialectic here, but if we could really understand that the higher up the ladder of evolution we get, as Teilhard insists, the energies themselves become more and more personalized. In all the dimensions that Teilhard talks about, spontaneity, freedom, intelligence, coherence, and agency. And we learn to look upon them not as them, but thou. And step more powerfully like those ancient structures of culture, the magic and mythical, into a world that is once again suffused with the magic, with the majesty and mystery of the divine, of the numinous, surrounding, organizing, and accompanying. And if we could only see that, it would change things in so many directions. You know, nowadays we do see them some ways, but we take that as a sort of private mystical vision and go write about it and, you know, tuck it in our pocket. If we could only see it as an objective truth of the world, that the structure of the universe is, as Teilhard said, love. And it's we that can't see it. And that doesn't mean that there isn't pain and heartbreak and idiocy and stupidity, but it means that we have a different ground in which to move forth into that. So these are just for me some of the points of, you know, when I said that we were going to talk about the differences this time, it wasn't to do that, well, this is this and this is this, he said this, she said this, you know, that's a divorce counseling. That it's rather to see that the energy that sparks between them when you push deeper into these places of apparent contradiction and see how they actually fulfill and round out each other and complement each other and give us a whole, you know, my stake in this is a path to our essential human task that we can actually live and walk as we move into the next iteration, which I think we all know is gathering. So that's probably enough for me to talk about right now.